How many of you remember playing dodgeball? Probably when you were a kid, although I do hear that there are some adult dodgeball leagues going on now. I remember back in grade school playing dodgeball in gym class. I think that's probably who invented dodgeball. Some poor gym teacher that had a rainy day needed something to do inside. But the rules of dodgeball were real simple. If somebody threw a ball and it hit you, you're out. If you caught it, they're out. Unless it hits you in the face, then the person who threw it, they were the ones that were out. And whoever the last one is still in wins. Well, there were two types of players in dodgeball I learned very quickly. There were the athletic types, and they would go right up to the line and dare people to throw them the ball because they were going to catch it. And then that person would be out, and then they'd throw it at somebody else and knock them out. And then you had the not-so-athletic types who tended to hide wherever they could so they wouldn't get hit. I fell into the latter category, and I remember finding a person a little bit taller than me, and I stood right behind him. I thought, now they won't be able to hit me. Problem was, somebody threw a ball that was going right for that person's head, and they ducked. And it smacked me right in the face. At which point I wobbled over toward the sidelines and they said, "You're not out, the person hit you in the face." And I said, "Trust me, I'm out." And then I went and sat down. Well, I never did find the history of dodgeball, but I actually found an instance of dodgeball that dates all the way back to the ancient world. In fact, I think it find it in Scripture. It's not quite literally dodgeball, but you'll get my meaning in a moment. Turn with me, if you would, to the passage that was read earlier, John chapter 18. Beginning in verse 28, we're actually going to cross into chapter 19 this morning. Last Sunday, we considered the trials that Jesus underwent by the Jewish authorities. He was taken to the former high priest, Annas, who was the father-in-law of the current high priest. Then he was taken to Caiaphas's house and then back and forth. And then in our text this morning, we see that they bring Jesus to the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate. And it's here that we read of this age-old variation of the gym class game. I'm calling it playing dodgeball with the truth. Because that's what Pilate tried to do. And you're going to see that people still play this game today as well. Verse 28 through 30 speak of the dilemma that Pilate encountered. The Jews led Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. It was now early morning, probably between 6 and 7 a.m. And it was not unusual in those days for legal proceedings to begin that early in the morning because, frankly, the Roman governor wanted to get done and over with. So it was not unusual for this to take place. Now, they wouldn't go into his palace because there was a custom. This is not found in the Old Testament, but it was a Jewish custom that if you entered the house of a Gentile, you were ceremonially unclean for a period of time. And since the Passover was coming up, they didn't want to defile themselves, and so they just stood outside, and Pilate actually came out and met with them. So Pilate comes out and he asks, "What charges are you bringing against this man?" This was the typical beginning of a Roman trial. When a person was on trial there in Rome or under the Roman government, it began with a listing of the charges. "What charges are you bringing against this man?" To which the Jewish leaders replied, "If he weren't a criminal, we wouldn't have handed him over to us." They weren't prepared for that. I don't know why, because from all that we've read so far, it appears that this thing was all choreographed. They had this all set up ahead of time, but they just came out with this very generic, "Well, he's obviously a criminal or we wouldn't be here." At which point Pilate says, "Fine, judge him according to your own law." Pilate really didn't want anything to do with this matter, as we're going to see throughout this account. Now, many of the people that are familiar with the Good Friday episode, you're at least knowledgeable of the name Pontius Pilate, right? Except for the little Sunday school boy who took Pilate to mean the flyer of a plane, most of us have at least heard of Pontius Pilate. I think, though, most of us have gotten a pretty bad impression of Pilate as a basically a bumbling idiot that was easily manipulated so that the Jews could get their desires quite easily. And that's really not the case. History does not bear that out at all. Paul Meyer is an ancient historian. He's done a lot of work. In fact, he's written an entire book on Pontius Pilate. And he writes, Pilate ruled as a prefect of Judea from 26 to 36 AD, the second longest tenure of any first century governor in Palestine. The very length of his office contradicts the usual impression of Pilate as an incompetent official, for it is doubtful that the emperor Tiberius, who insisted on good provincial administration, would have retained Pilate in office so long if he had been a political cripple. He did, however, find the governorship of Judea a taxing experience, and several vignettes of Pilate show remarkably modern problems that he had to face as an ancient administrator. Aside from his familiar role on Good Friday, there are five other incidents involving Pilate that are reported by first century authors Josephus and Philo. Because it seems that Pilate blundered in each of these instances, he's been roundly faulted for his performance as governor in most history since that time. Yet a close study of these episodes would suggest that Pilate, while hardly a master of diplomacy, was at least trying to make the best of very difficult administrative situations. Now, we don't have time in our study today to go into these other episodes, but they're there. They're written down in history. And it shows that Pilate was at least a capable governor, though, again, he may not have been a master of diplomacy or tact. And he was just trying to make the best of a very difficult situation. In modern days, we would say he was between a rock and a hard place. Now we begin this game. Pilate plays dodgeball with the truth. Throughout this episode, you see Pilate trying to find loopholes that'll please both sides and get him out of the situation. I want to point out five diversions that Pilate endeavored to avoid dealing with the truth that was staring him right in the face. First, Pilate tries circumvention. Verse 31, he says, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." In effect, he was basically saying, "Do what you want. You've got this man, do whatever. You want to take him out and stone him according to your law, go ahead." And he was, in essence, telling the Sanhedrin, if they wanted to put Jesus to death, Rome would turn a blind eye at this time. Now, in reality, what Pilate was doing was trying to put the responsibility on somebody else. I don't want to deal with this, you do it. He was just trying to circumvent the whole case right from the get-go. I want to deal with it. And I think many people have continued to do that down through the ages. Some will say, I don't know what to believe about Jesus, let the scholars deal with that. You know, I don't know enough. I'm not informed enough. I don't really need to make a decision here. But as William Barclay writes, that is precisely what no one can do. No one can deal with Jesus for us. We must deal with him ourselves. And this first diversion that Pilate tries doesn't work. So the second diversion he attempts is cynicism. Verses 33 through 38, Pilate went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, and said, "Are you king of the Jews?" Jesus said, "Is that your own idea, or did others talk to you about me?" "Am I a Jew?" Pilate replied. Can you hear the sarcasm? "What, am I a Jew? Are you kidding me? No, I'm a Roman." And Romans look down their noses on Jews. So it's a very condescending statement here. He's being very cynical. I'm not a Jew. I'm not at that level. And then notice, Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. Pilate says, oh, well, you are a king then. Once again, I'm hearing a tone here, very cynical. Now, there's probably a reason for that, because there were a lot of false messiahs that had come up just in the years before Jesus. There had been a number of these pseudo-messiahs who would rally the people together and say, we're going to kick Rome out and start an uprising, and then they would have to be put down by the army. So Pilate may have had good cause to be cynical here. But I think you can hear that. And then Jesus says, yeah, you're right, I am a king. And I testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. And then Pilate comes up with probably his most famous line, what is truth? Now, taken at face value, that looks like a legitimate question. What is truth? And that's a question people have been asking down through the ages. The problem is, I don't think Pilate was legitimate. Because you'll notice, he didn't even stick around for the answer. He said, oh, what is truth? And walked off. So he tried to take an attitude that would keep him from really having to deal with the issues. And how often when we encounter people about the gospel, do we come against that? People today try to dodge the truth behind a mask of cynicism. Oh, you can't believe that Bible. It was written so many years ago, and how do you know it's been copied correctly? You can't really believe Jesus was the Son of God. Oh, come on, that's fairy tale stuff. You mean all those miracles in the Bible? No, nobody in their right mind would accept that. And that's an attitude you hear a lot today in our society. I've noticed something just in recent months. I think Hollywood has taken a new tactic against Christianity. Rather than trying to attack it from the front, rather than trying to dissuade people from believing in it because it can't be true, you know, Dan Brown's whole thing with the Da Vinci Code was an absolute flop. What you see now in movies and on television screens, Christianity is now being laughed at. We're going to paint Christians in such a way that nobody can take them seriously. And how many times you see somebody, oh, I'm a Christian, I believe in Jesus, and they're going out and, you know, breaking the law, or they're messing around, or they're, you know, getting drunk or doing whatever. They talk about all these things that they do, but, oh, Jesus Christ is my Savior. What does that do to the image of Christianity in the modern mind? Makes it a joke. And people will try to dodge the truth. They'll try to hide behind this cynical outlook. Oh, Christians are a bunch of hypocrites. I don't have to take that seriously. We see people even today who would rather laugh off the truth than think about it. Then Pilate tries a change of venue. We don't see that here. It's not recorded by John, but it is recorded in Luke chapter 23. In Luke chapter 23, Luke is recording the same events. It's the same trial before Pilate. Beginning in verse 5, he says, the Jews insisted he stirs up people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here. They're trying to impress upon Pilate that this is a dangerous man. That it's not just a local problem, but he started all the way up north in Galilee, and he's spreading his dangerous teachings all the way down to Jerusalem. But when Pilate hears that word Galilee, a light bulb clicks on. On hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at the time. Now, in legal terms, we would call this a change of venue. If somebody's been accused of a particularly notorious crime, their lawyer will often ask for a change of venue. We want the trial to be held somewhere else because this has gotten so much news that nobody is going to be be able to be objective. And so they ask that that it be moved. Well, what Pilate does is, I don't want to deal with this case, so I'm going to move it somewhere else. And he sent Jesus to Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas was one of the sons of Herod the Great. And after Herod the Great died, his kingdom was split among his sons. And Herod Antipas part of his kingdom was the area of Galilee. This is the same Herod who beheaded John the Baptist. Same guy. So Jesus is sent. And when Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased, because for a long time he had been wanting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform some miracle. Here comes Jesus. Oh, hey, let's put on a show. Hey, gather around, everybody. This prophet from Galilee's come. This miracle worker's coming. Let's see if he'll do us a trick. Jesus, perform some miracle. Show us your power. Jesus wouldn't comply. Jesus wouldn't even say a word. He wasn't going to fall into that trap. And so Herod gets disappointed, and he sends him back to Pilate. So here's another attempt that Pilate has, trying to dodge the truth. Doesn't work. It always comes back to Pilate. He always ends up hitting him right in the face. But you see this same kind of thing when you deal with people today and you try to tell them about Jesus. They'll try to divert the attention somewhere else. How many of you have heard this one? I know I have. You talk to somebody about God and they say, well, if God's so good, why do innocent children suffer? Like that excuses them from having to deal with anything else. I had one person who genuinely asked that question and stuck around long enough for the answer. And I was able to lead that person to Christ. But most of the time, when somebody asks that question, they're slamming the door of their mind shut just after the last word is said. They don't want to hear it. It's just a convenient question to slam the door in the face of truth that they don't want to have to deal with. So they try to divert the attention somewhere else. Next, Pilate tries compromise. And you're probably familiar with this story back in John 18, beginning of verse 38. Pilate says, well, you Jews have this tradition. It's Passover time. We grant amnesty to a prisoner. We'll set a prisoner free, and you can choose. I'll give you a choice. It's up to you. I won't do this. You can choose between Jesus, who's your king, and this no-good scumbag Barabbas. He was a revolutionary. He was a murderer. He was the kind of person that when you saw on the street, you grabbed your kids and made sure that they were safe. I mean, he was just as despicable a person as could be. Pilate's thinking this is going to be an easy choice. And it got turned around on him. But really what Pilate was trying to do was to get the best of both worlds. You see, if his plan succeeded, Jesus would be released. But, technically speaking, if the people asked for Pilate to release Jesus, Pilate would be calling Jesus guilty. It's like if you are granted a pardon. If you accept the pardon, that's an admission of guilt, right? Because you don't need a pardon if you're not guilty. In order for Pilate to release Jesus under this amnesty program, then technically speaking, he would have convicted him of the crime, but then released him. So that if the Jews had gone back to Tiberius and said, he let this man go who's a revolutionary, Pilate could say, look, I convicted the man, but because of their custom, I let him go. Compromise. Trying to give a little bit. Not willing to go all the way. But trying to get the best of both worlds, and that's become the creed of many people in our world. They want to run with Jesus in this life, but rest with, run with the world and the devil in this life, and rest with Jesus in the next. They want to go to church on Sunday, but live however they want the rest of the week. They don't want to be too religious because it might cost them their family, might cost them their friends. Their business colleagues might look down on them. But they want to have that feeling of security that's offered by God. So you see this trying to do a little bit of both. Now what Pilate did when the amnesty didn't work, he had Jesus flogged. Now, none of us can imagine how awful a Roman scourging was. Not even for those of you that saw Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ. And that movie was brutal in its depiction. Even it didn't come close when it came to scourging. The Roman whip that they used was like a cat of nine tails. But in each of the leather strips, they put pieces of broken bone and glass and metal. So that when it hit the skin, it literally ripped the skin off. Roman history records many people died from the scourging. Just from that itself. It was so brutal. And I don't think even Hollywood could portray how it really was. But what Pilate was doing was he saying, well, if I do this, maybe I won't have to crucify him. I'll try to play up to the sympathy of the people. See, he's trying to go part way, but not all the way. Now, what happened? Yeah, he scourged Jesus so that he wouldn't be crucified. Well, Jesus ended up getting both. He ended up with the worst end of both. And unfortunately, that's what happens when people try to compromise today. They think they're going to get a little of each, but what happens is they get the worst of both. You know, can you imagine anybody so pitiful as someone who tries to live a religious life, somebody who sacrifices all the worldly pleasures of this life so they don't have any fun as far as the world is concerned, but they don't come to Christ, so they end up spending eternity in hell anyway. Talk about losing at both ends. But that's what happens when people compromise. Oh, I'm not going to be a Christian, but I'll be religious. You're going to be miserable now and in eternity. Pilate tried to give a little and get a little, and it just didn't work. Now, if Pilate had any integrity at all, what he should have done is said, this man's not guilty. I'm dismissing the case. How many times does he say in this passage, I find no fault in this man? He is saying he's not guilty. I mean, it can't be any clearer than that, but Pilate is not willing to stand up for what's right because there's too much at stake. He has too much he can lose. And so he tries to compromise, but the more he tried to wiggle out of this predicament, the more entangled he became. Now, just as the prosecution was seeing their case slip away, they played their trump card. They said, if you let this man go, you are not a friend of Caesar. Now, this just doesn't mean he wouldn't be buddy-buddy with the emperor anymore. There was an actual club. In the Latin, they called it the Amici Caesaris, Friends of Caesar. And if you were a part of that club, you got a ring with the emperor's name on it. And there were special events in Rome, like the emperor's birthday or different holidays, that you got to, you know, it was a members only kind of an invitation. And that was a lifelong membership that you only lost in the case of high treason or some other terrible crime. And the only way you lost your place was either exile or suicide. There weren't too many ex-friends of Caesar. You just didn't have it. So when the Jews come and say, you're not a friend of Caesar, they're saying you are going to be taken out of the club. Because one of the episodes we didn't get into detail, 5 months before Good Friday, there had been a problem there with the Jews. And the Jewish leader sent a delegation to Rome saying, your man Pilate just can't get it right. He's offended us once again on a matter of our custom. And honestly, Pilate was in the right. He was standing up for Rome. But the Jews didn't like it. So they sent off a delegation to Tiberius and said, your man Pilate just doesn't have the touch. Tiberius sent a letter, which is still around in history, which was in very nasty Latin. He was basically cussing out Pilate, saying, do not, under any circumstances, rile these people up again. You've got to acknowledge their customs, and we were trying to keep peace here. If there's any other problems, you will be recalled. Now, keep that in mind when you hear what they say to him. You are no longer Caesar's friend. This is a threat. You do what we say, or we're going to send another delegation to Rome, and there will not be another chance. You will be recalled. You will lose your position. And very possibly you could lose your life. And so finally, Pilate crumbles into capitulation. He admits defeat. He abandons Jesus to the mob because he did not have the courage to make the right decision, do the right thing. He wasn't going to admit to the truth, and so what else was left? Self-preservation. Got to look out for number one. So Pilate, knowing full well that Jesus was innocent, knowing full well that they had no case against him, ruled against him anyway and said, let him be crucified. And oftentimes you see people doing that as well. They're faced with a tough choice between the truth and between popularity, between their job, between their career, between their pleasures. I know of somebody that said, I can't become a Christian because I'd have to give up pornography. Well, I mean, I'm glad that he saw that there was a distinction there. You know, at least he recognized that, but he wasn't willing to give it up. And there are many people that will capitulate against the truth because it costs too much. But there was one last thing that he tried to do. And I find this even happens today. I call it compensation. Even as he sentenced Jesus to death to be crucified, he wrote a note that's supposed to go on top of the cross that says, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. And the Jewish leaders came back and said, don't write that. Just say, I said I'm the King of the Jews. And Pilate says, no, what I've written, I've written. This is your king and you're crucifying him. Tried to compensate. And people try to do that too. You know, well, I'm not going to be a Christian, but, you know, God, I'll give money to this good cause. Or I'll volunteer, or I'll do this or that. They're not willing to go all the way with the truth. They're not willing to commit themselves to God, but I'll do some good things here and there and that'll compensate for it. Doesn't work. It doesn't work. Jesus makes a demand that is absolute. And it's only an absolute commitment that will meet that demand. Now, I've already touched on it, but I want to return to the decision Pilate entered at the conclusion of this case. You see, all throughout this case, Pilate is trying to avoid making a choice. He's trying to avoid a decision. But in avoiding the choice, he's really making a choice. And that's true for people today. Somebody says, well, I'm not gonna deal with this now, I'll deal with it later. Or, you know, I don't have to deal with Jesus right now. You're making a choice by not making a choice. You see, we're already going down the path toward an eternity in hell. Every person who has ever lived is heading that way. Unless they make that commitment to get off, that's where they're going. So by not choosing, you're already going down that path. The choice has already been made. And as much as Pilate tried to get out of making a choice, he was actually making the choice. And from the beginning of human history, until the final chapter is written, mankind is confronted with a choice about the truth. Now, the lesson we can learn from this passage is that we cannot play dodgeball with the truth. At some point, we have to face it and declare our allegiance. Now, if we're going to be like Pilate and try to please everybody, we're going to be pulled in many directions at once, we'll end up pleasing nobody, including ourselves. You know, we may face the easy road, the path of popularity, the avenue of affluence. We might fear what others may think if we stand up for what we know is right. We may be afraid of what we would have to give up in order to follow Jesus. We might, like Pilate, try to divert attention away from the real issues and ultimately away from ourselves. But the truth has a way of finding us. Just like when I tried to hide behind that tall kid in gym class, the truth hit me right in the face. And the truth is going to confront every single person. And a decision must be made. Remember the old commercials for Fram oil filters. You can pay me now, or you can pay me later. And the idea was you can buy this $5 or $10 oil filter now, or you can pay several hundred dollars when I have to rebuild your engine and it's burned up. In a sense, that's what's confronting every person. You can confront the truth now, or you can confront the truth later. But when you confront the truth later, it's too late. You know, every knee will bow before Jesus and call Him Lord. The choice is whether you do it willingly in this life or whether you're forced to on your way to hell. Because there is no middle ground. We have to face the truth. Pilate said, "What is truth?" But he didn't hang around for the answer. If he had, he might have heard Jesus say, "I am the truth. No one comes to the Father except through me." And if we are truly wanting to know what the truth is, He is the answer. And that is the decision that we all must face. Our invitation hymn says it best. What will you do with Jesus? That third verse, will you evade Him as Pilate tried, or will you choose Him, whate'er betide? Vainly you struggle from Him to hide. You can't hide from the truth. And if you haven't made that decision, if you haven't made that commitment, you still have that chance. You still can do the right thing. Don't wait until it's too late. Don't be like Pilate and try every other way to get out of it, and then finally you just give in. Come to Jesus while you have that chance. We're going to sing just the third verse of hymn number 304. Again, if you've never made that decision, I can't make it for you, and nobody else can. Don't put it off, because you don't know how much longer you have. And if we wait until we're standing before Him, it will be too late. We're just going to sing the third verse.